for the IC lens. Up we go until my head knocked against the plaster, and I hooked the old girl on the end of the curtain rail by her back collar and left her there flapping and yapping and kicking her little arms and legs in the air, and nothing she could do about it. Now, I can negotiate from a position of strength, I says. How much did he really offer?
1,000. Let me down.
And she yips and yells. How much did he put down in advance? I demanded, for I am an honest girl.
1/2 in advance. Let me down.
But I descend alone and plunge both hands in the safe, intending to take from it only what is mine by rights, plus her commission. But while I sat on her bed counting out the shiners, comes a diabolical knocking at the door. Whoever knocks has ripped off the muffling crepe to make his point. You never heard such a din. The gold it was that trapped me, for I could not bear to cast aside that glinting pile of treasure and flee, even when I heard furious footsteps on the stairs. Toussaint hurtles in, pale beneath his pigmentation, making the wildest gestures with his hands, and on his heels, two great louts with gallows meat all over them, rigged out in tunics, sandals and cloaks like a comic opera, and they hold between them a fishing net. I spread my wings immediately, but whither shall I fly? The windows is all boarded over. Is it up to the ceiling to hover there all night? Join my old madame on the other end of the curtain rod, to lodge there with her like a pair of gargoyles? My wits deserted me, and as I fluttered like the cornered bird I was, these bullies trawled me in a trice and hauled me off downstairs, banging my bum on each step as I went down, leaving behind us a gaping safe, a heap of money, a confounded manservant, and the old bat hanging halfway to heaven, which is as far to it as she'll ever get, rot her soul. The front door slammed behind the thrashing bundle of frightened feathers that was myself. I am deposited in a four-wheeler and whirled off into the night. I demand of these fine gentlemen, where are you taking me? But each sits still as a statue with his arms folded on his chest, staring straight in front of him, and never says one word. The blinds pulled down, the horses galloping like blazes. And I'll resign myself to the hazard of events, sir, since I can do nothing else.
Chapter 5.
As I judged it, not more than 2 hours passed before the horses moderated their headlong passage. We halted. One bully opened the door and the other took the net off me, and doing so took care to get a good feel of my titties. I smashed him in the mouth with my elbow and he gave over with a curse. I wrapped myself up in the travelling rug and, shrugging the buggers off, stepped proudly out of that carriage under my own steam, as if invited, not kidnapped. I saw before me a mansion in the Gothic style, all ivied over, and above the turret floated a fingernail moon with a star in its arms. Somewhere a dog howling. Around us, a secrecy of wooded hills. Although this mansion was antique in design, in execution it was new. Raw brick showed through the ivy, and the front door of fumed oak had fresh brass plates hammered in to simulate studs. This door stood open, and let out a great deal of bright light from the vestibule. The bullies grabbed hold one of each my arms again, and would have frog-marched me up the front steps except I wrestled free, but nowhere to go except that door, which shut behind me with a bang. Only the current copy of the London Times laying on an oak chest was proof I had not been somehow magically transported into an earlier age, in which all was new because it was new, not because it was a repro. I stood in a square antechamber of large, square-hewn stones. The floor flagged, the roof fluted, and in the central groin, aptly enough, the same figure of the winged, rosy phallus as Mr. Rosenkreutz wore round his neck. This was carved in some dark stone, perhaps marble. All brightly lit, as I judged by electricity, but the sources of illumination concealed here and there in folds of walls. Through a stone portal was a small room all panelled, and I could see a man sitting in one of a pair of carved oak chairs beside a low oak table with a lovely vase of white roses on it. His face was hidden because he was reading in a big book like a Bible with clasps. For 1 minute, I didn't recognise Mr. Rosenkreutz without his hat. Bald as an egg he surely was. His head gleamed as if the maid had gone over it with the same cloth she used on the silver. He didn't have his plum-coloured frock on either, but a sort of long white nightshirt tied with a rope. But when I saw his pendant, I knew my man, and bitterly regretted the 1,000 guineas I'd left behind at Madame Shrek's, I can tell you. Then I remembered how the deal had been, half on account, half on delivery. There was another pony owing, so very politely I gives him a "Good evening, Mr. Rosenkreutz." Now he condescends to lower his book and look me over, and I do not doubt I am a disappointment to him, bundled up in his old rug and all a mess, but he doesn't let on by a flicker of a muscle. "Welcome, Azrael," he says. "Azrael, Azrael, Ashriel, Azrael, Azaril, Gabriel, dark angel of many names, welcome to me, from your home in the third heaven. See, I welcome you with roses no less paradoxically vernal than your presence, who, like Proserpine, comes from the land of the dead to herald new life." Which is all very well, no doubt, but I thought in that case the least he could do was to ask me to sit down, and he never thinks of that, nor does he even offer me so much as a cup of tea after the very trying journey I've had of it. But he goes on smiling at me, his poor old roomy eyes all aswim. "And what a pretty angel it is," he says sentimentally, "even if it does have a smut on its nose. Show us the bathroom and let's have a wash then," I smartly riposts, and he stops admiring his purchase sharpish, as if he hadn't bargained for it talking back. Am I crestfallen, he mumbles. "Through that door, up the staircase, first right on the landing," and goes back to his book, which, as I pass, I see is written in the Latin language and goes by the name of Mysterium Baphometis Revelatum. What a bathroom, dear God, talk about, his halls were made of marble, and towels an inch thick, and bags of hot water steaming out the taps. This is the life, I thought, and poured in half a bottle of Trumper's essence of lime before I immersed myself in the aromatic tub. But first of all, I hung my petticoats over the keyhole so Mr. Rosenkreutz couldn't take a peek. Now, sir, you may wonder how I deal with my wings whilst I bathe. Well, as with all fowl, my feathers are reasonably waterproof, but it's not water off a duck's back with me, alas. Best not get sodden, else I founders. I groom my wings a bit with my fingertips as far as I can reach and splash them a bit more and give myself a good shake, and then I'm good as new. So, I took care to keep my wings out of the bath, you see. But the rest of myself I wash perfectly normally, and what with his lemon soap and all, I had a fine old time. As I was mopping up with the bath sheet, I heard, as I had known I would, a scrabbling at the door, and I snap, "That's quite enough of that, and what's more, I'm not coming out this bathroom until you fetch me something decent to wear." "Well, I assure you," said Mr. Rosenkreutz, "it would go the worse for you, Azrael, if you should come out of your lustrations in the rags in which you entered them, so I propose a little riddle with you. Are you fond of riddles, Azrael?" I said nothing. "If," he says, "you solve this riddle, I will give you £100 gratuity over and above what is owed already, and nothing to do with Madame Shrek." "Riddle away," says I at once, and he snickers to himself with glee. "Beautiful lady, who is neither one thing nor the other, nor flesh nor fowl, though fair is foul and foul is fair. In order to enact the ritual for which I have engaged you, you must come out of the water neither naked nor clothed." He wheezes away behind the door with delight at his own ingenuity. "And I won't let you out of the bathroom until you're ready," he adds. Then the only sound through the keyhole is that of his heavy breathing. The thought of that £100 concentrated my mind wonderfully, and I sat down on the side of the bath until I'd puzzle my way out of the conundrum. As you can see, sir, nature has blessed me with exceedingly long and abundant hair, so I combed it out and covered myself up with it in the same way that Lady Godiva insubstantially yet modestly clothed herself on her celebrated ride through Coventry. I had more than enough air in which to hide myself, I'm happy to say, but how to make it all secure? Well, I plaited one single lock and chopped it off with Nelson's swordlet, that I'd kept with me, as always, tucked in my stays. And I used that plait to girdle my waist and make all secure, not forgetting to strap my gilded mascot next to my skin beneath it, I assure you. "Roger," I cried, unlocking the door and burst out upon him in a cloud of citron steam, and he gobbles away to himself with a mixture of gratification and perhaps regret, for who can tell what he'd thought up for me if I hadn't come up with the answer? I'm happy to say a very substantial meal has arrived in the reception room below while I'm having my wash and brush up, salad and cheese and a cold bird, which I'm that famished I nibble a drumstick of, though if there's the option I won't touch a morsel of chicken or duck or guinea fowl and so on, not wanting to play cannibal. But this time in my extremity, I whisper a prayer of forgiveness to my feathery forebears and tuck in. And there's a very decent bottle of claret to wash it down, so I have some of that. Straightway, Mr. Rosenkreuz starts to ramble on. Don't you run away with the idea there's anything fleshly, indecent, or even remotely corporeal about our meeting this night of all nights, when the shining star lies in the moon's chaste embrace above this very house, signifying the defying post-diluvian remission and reconciliation of the terrible, for there is a secret admonition of which the motto of pure courtesy is an obfuscation, for it is not Oni soit qui mal y pense, but Yoni soit qui mal y pense. Yoni, of course, in the Hindu, the female part, or absence, or atrocious hole, or dreadful chasm, the abyss down below, the vortex that sucks everything dreadfully down, 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 where terror rules. So that was the signification of his gold medallion. The penis, represented by itself, aspires upwards, represented by the wings, that is dragged downwards, represented by the twining stem, by the female part, represented by the rose. This is some kind of heretical, possibly Manchian version of Neoplatonic Rosicrucianism, thinks I to myself. Tread carefully, girlie, I exhort myself. He so appalled himself at the notion of the orifice that the poor old sod mumbles and whimpers himself to a halt, though he's no stranger to the abyss himself. He used to come every Sunday just to convince himself it was as horrible as he'd always thought. I pour myself another glass of claret to strengthen myself, and one for mine host, too, who seems to need it. He tosses it off absent-mindedly, and after a few moments recovers his equanimity sufficient to turn his mind to happier things. Flora! He cries. Quick spirit of the awakening world, winged and aspiring upwards. Flora! Azrael! Venus Pandemos! These are but a few of the many names with which I might honour my goddess, but tonight I shall call you Flora. Very often. For do you not know what night it is, Flora? I try a dollop of his excellent Stilton, pondering as I savour it the baroque eclecticism of his mythology. April 30th, I say, suspicious lest this turns out to be another riddle. May Eve, Flora mia, he assures me. In but a few moments, it will be your day, the green hint of the year. The door of spring will open up to let summer through. It will be the merry morning of May. I nervously fortify myself with another glass of wine. Now, the maple is self-evidently nothing but the representation of a phallus, i.e. a lingam, i.e. a piercing and fructifying spear such as the lance of Longius. Note the long lance of Longius. But here he blinks and stutters, for he's about to lose his way in his own mythology, and wax Arthurian, which will lead him up a blind alley in next to no time. He pours himself more claret with a shaking hand and lurches back to his fertility rites. Maple, phallus, lingam, ha, up! Heave ho, and up he rises! Up tomorrow on all the village greens of merry England will spring the sacred phalloi of this blessed season. And that is why, tonight of all nights, I chose to spirit you away from the dark house, the abyss, the Erebus of perpetual winter, ruled over by the old gnome of hell, Madame Shrek. Now, old gnome of hell fitted the said Mrs. S. to a T, so I thought the fool may speak some sense in the midst of his folly, and looked at him more kindly. "Would you like to know his name, sir?" She interrupted herself abruptly, giving Walter the touch of an eye like sudden blue steel. Her hairpins had all given away under the tumultuous impulses of her half-hundredweight of hair that now flowed and tumbled all around her, and she had become somewhat flushed, giving her a wild and meaned air. Walser wilted in the blast of her full attention.
"You don't half look done in, sir,"
said Lizzie, with unexpected concern, and Walser did indeed feel himself at the point of prostration. The hand that followed their dictations across the page obediently as a little dog no longer felt as if it belonged to him. It flapped at the hinge of the wrist. All the same, "No, no," he lied, "I'll be fine." "You must know this gentleman's name," insisted Feathers, and seizing his notebook, wrote it down. She had a fine, firm, flowing italic hand. On reading it,
"Good God," said Walser.
"I saw in the paper, only yesterday, how he gives the most impressive speech in the House on the subject of votes for women, which he is against, on account of how women are of a different soul substance from men, cut from a different bolt of spirit cloth, and altogether too pure and rarefied to be bothering their pretty little heads with things of this world, such as the Irish question in the Boer War."
"In the course of our interminable, if one-sided conversation, he reveals to me how he is much afraid of growing old. And indeed who isn't? Who doesn't fear the relentless spinning of the celestial wheel off which one day all are doomed to topple? And after much hemming and hawing and mystical circumlocution, at last he gives it to me. That the sage Artephius invented a cabalistic magnet which secretly sucked out the bodies of young women their mysterious spirit of efflorescence."
"Efflorescence, Flora?"
he says, with a significant intonation. "By applying a concentration of these spirits to himself by his magic arts, and continually rejuvenating himself, it was spring all year long with Artephius, and so Mr. Rosenkreutz hopes it will be for him. Furthermore, opines Mr. Rosenkreutz, didn't King David, when he grew old, take Abishag the Shulamite to lie in his bosom, and thereby he got heat, and lived 200-300 years more, and turned into one of the nine worthies? He went on, too, about a certain Signor Guardi, whom Mr. Rosenkreutz himself had met in Venice, and this Signor Guardi possessed a portrait of himself as a young man, painted by Titian, proving this Signor Guardi was a cool 300 years old or so. And he told Mr. Rosenkreutz how he had himself rubbed all over by a baker's dozen young girls from the Apennines, their massage oil consisting of a distillation of spring flowers and chemical extracts known only to himself. But there came an exceedingly furtive expression over Mr. Rosenkreutz's face when he spoke of Signor Guardi's prescription, and I thought, there's something here he's keeping to himself. But this he will say, that since he first grew versed in esoteric lore and the magic arts, he has known of my existence, of the bright angel who will release him from the bonds of the material, the winged spirit of universal springtime. New too, I was locked away beneath the ground in hell. I thinks to that, and again, when he starts rummaging away in his book and jabbing his stubby finger at the pages that tell him death and life are all the same. And then the book slipped off his lap due to his trembling, and at last, blushing and stumbling in his speech, lowering his voice, he tells me how he thinks that by uniting his body with that of Azrael, the angel of death, on the threshold of the spring, he would cheat death itself and live forever, while Flora herself will be forever free of winter's chill. This he has proved in the 7 weeks since he first saw me by all manner of cabalistic geometry, of which he will gladly, he says, show me the proofs. But I poured out the last of the claret without offering him some, for I thought 2,000 guineas was cheap at the price and said so, but he was too far sunk in his own ecstatic reveries to hear me. I thought the least he could do was crack another bottle of claret, seeing as he was getting eternal life dirt cheap, and I was obtaining only half the profit from this bizarre transaction. But he was temporarily blind and deaf to the world, hearkening only to the invisible angel shouting in his ears, so I rapped loudly with a book upon the table, and that brought one of his bullies in, at the double, out of a door of a secret kind concealed in the panelling. If the gentleman were not so exalted by the presence of his visitor, I'm sure he'd order up another bottle, I says. Let's try the 88 vintage this time, if the cellar will run to it. for I do like a nice glass of good wine when I get the chance, Mr. Walzer.
In comparison with the hermetic adepts, monarchs are poor, mumbles Mr. Rosenkreutz, sunk in his dreams. And the bully tips me a wink as he piles the dirty crocks on the tray, mutters. He keeps his wallet in the top drawer of the bureau in the bedroom. You'll see it. Remember me.
Indeed, I remember him. He's the one groped my right tit. And I'm almost sorry for my poor gull with his fancy-dress notions, fleeced by his servants, deluded by charlatans, until the rogue returns with a bottle. Mr. Rosenkreutz wakes up with a start, says,
"What's this? Can't have your vital spirits dulled by base vapours."
And upends the claret into the jug of white roses, which blush. So, I must sit on a horrid hard chair, parched with thirst, and wait for dawn to get the business over with, for I plan to pick up the cash owing to me and so depart. Not never back to Madame Schreck, of course, but straight home to Battersea. For what Mr. Rosenkreutz is willing to pay for the privilege of busting a scrap of cartilage was quite sufficient to set my entire family up in comfort, I can tell you. And I passed the hours of that short summer night happily enough, fool that I was, for I was busy building castles in the air, while Mr. Rosenkreutz repeats his cryptic orisons, for he seemed so excited by the apotheosis he thinks is offered by my embraces as to appear half-crazed. Somewhere a clock tells the hours, and when it gets to 4 or 4:15, he comes to his senses somewhat and tells me I must prepare myself.
"Prepare myself how, master?"
I ask craftily.
"By pure thoughts,"
he says, and apostrophizes me.
"Queen of ambiguities, goddess of in-between states, being on the borderline of species, manifestation of Ariorif, Venus, Archamatoth, Sophia."
I can't tell you what a turn it gave me when he called me Sophia. How did he stumble over my christened name? It was as if it put me in his power, that he should know my name, and though I am not ordinarily superstitious, now I became strangely fearful.
"Lady of the hub of the celestial wheel, creature half of earth and half of air, virgin and whore, reconciler of fundament and firmament, reconciler of opposing states through the mediation of your ambivalent body, reconciler of the grand opposites of death and life, you who come to me neither naked nor clothed, wait with me for the hour when it is neither dark nor light, that to dawn before daybreak, when you shall give yourself to me, but I shall not possess you."
Give yourself? That's rich, I thought, considering the amounts of money changing hands. But I outwardly adopted a submissive stance, and asked in a humble voice, "How shall I do that, O great sage?"
"The rest of the riddle you must answer at the appointed hour,"
he intones, so I had to make do with that. "You may well wonder, sir, why I hadn't hopped straight out the window and away long ago. But all I knew of my location was that his house was somewhere in the home counties, and further than that I couldn't for the life of me think where it was. And wouldn't I be in a pickle, then, out in the middle of nowhere in me altogether, flapping for cover from tree to tree like a bloody dog all the way to Battersea? I must say, too, that I both hate and fear the open country. I do not like to be where man is not, I tell you straight. I love the sight and stink and bustle of humanity as I love my life, and a bit of landscape that has no people in it, no friendly smoke rising from the chimney of some human habitation, is as good as desert waste to me. Not that I ever spent much time in the woods and fields, I'm happy to say, but sometimes in Ma Nelson's day on August Bank Holiday, she'd pack us all up into a barouche and off we'd go to the New Forest for a picnic. And I was always heartily glad to get back to Wapping High Street, for there I breathe more easy. Cockney to the bone, sir. Besides, sir, I am an honest woman, and the poor old bugger had put his cash down on the nail, hadn't he, even if I'd pocketed none of it so far. But I'd high hopes of that 1,000 on delivery, plus the extra 100 he'd promised me. Why, I'd already bought one of those nice big houses off Lavender Hill, and fixed Gianni and his otter and Violetta and Lizzie and me and the rest of us up in it, nice as you please. It was the promise of hard cash kept me there. And, well, I thought I'd not have too much trouble with the old fool when it came to the pinch, because he had the look of a Johnny come quickly, I can tell you. and in my innocence of a worse fate than that fate, why, I never thought. So time passed as it sometimes does, he babbling to himself, until those leaded panes grow pale, at which he bursts into song.
Unite and unite, oh, let us all unite, for summer is a-coming today.
And jumps up, switches off the electrics, flings open the casement. A little spring wind, still with chill on it, blows into the room, and silly, tender-hearted me, I fear for his middle-aged health. You mind your bare head, or you'll catch your death. That word, death, has an electrifying effect upon him. He brayed and neighed, quivered and whinnied, clinging on to the casement frame as if without its support, down he would flop. But the spasm soon over. He quavered.
Oh, my rejuvenatrix, the fructifying disc is just now nudging his way up the backside of yonder hillock. Lie down on the altar.
Mr. Walter, sir, though I blush to admit it to a man, intact as I am, I knew enough to know if I got down on my back, not only would it hold no joy for me, but the ensuing attempt at connection would cause a commotion similar to a bout of all-in wrestling in a pillow factory. You may take me exclusively by the rear entry, O great sage, due to my feathers, I warned him hastily, though I questioned in my mind his dislike of the orifice, and even then, as in a flash of understanding, it comes to me that his idea of sex magic and my own might not concur.
Never you mind that, he cried in a frenzy. Just you lie down.
Capering back to me, he clears off the table on which my supper had been served with one swipe of his scrawny arm, knocking book and roses to the floor. Yet for all the sacred terror of his blue features, I spied in them something else. Something that troubled me dreadfully. For it was just that look of anticipated naughtiness I've caught on the face of my goddaughter Violetta, when she's just about to plunge her fingers into the forbidden glories of the chocolate ice. And then I think, this man is going to do me harm. Seeing the shadow of reluctance on my face, he recovers himself a little, and summoning to himself all the authority of a captain of industry, repeats, "Lie down upon the altar!" Wondering, I stretch out face down on the coffee table. He approaches with a purposeful stride. I'd have clenched my teeth and thought of England had not I glimpsed, peering over my shoulder, a shining something lying along his hairy old gnarled old thigh as his robe swung loose. This something was a sight more aggressive than his other weapon, poor thing, that bobbed about uncharged, unprimed, unsharpened. In the cold grey light of May morning, I saw this something was a blade. Quick as a flash, out with my own. How I bless my little gilded sword. He fell back, babbling, "Unfair, unfair." He not thought the angel would come armed. Yet, sir, strike, I could not, nor arm another mortal even in self-defence. And to tell the truth, even in the midst of my consternation, I was tickle pink to see the poor old booby struck all of a heap to see his plans awry, and he was as much put out when I laughed in his face as he was to see old Nelson's plaything. Before he'd gathered his wits together, I was off and out of that open casement like greased lightning, I can tell you, although it was a tight squeeze, and I left enough feathers to stuff a mattress caught on the frame. The mad bastard let out a shrill high squeak to see his fleshy bottle of elixir vitae take off, and only then came after me with what turned out to be an antique spear he'd found somewhere or other, and even succeeded in inflicting a flesh wound on the ball of my right foot, of which I still bear the scar. Look! She withdrew one foot from its carpet slipper and thrust it onto Walser's knee, dislodging his notebook so that it fell to the floor. Across the sole there ran a pale, puckered seam of flesh. "Oracular proof," said Lizzie, smothering a yawn.
"Seeing is believing."
Walser weakly retrieved his notebook. "But for that upward leap earlier in the evening in Madame Shrek's bedroom, I hadn't tried my wings for a cool 6 months. But fright lent me more than human powers. I soared up and away from that vile place, over the maypole on the front lawn towards which, even at that moment, a troop of children he must have hired from the village came trotting in flimsy gauze tunics, in spite of the drizzle, with daisy chains in their hair, ready to dance and sing for the hideously refreshed adept who'd planned to make a May sacrifice of me, sir. They all scattered in fright, bawling for their mars as I flew by. I took refuge in a nearby spinney, in the top branches of an elm, where I startled a sleepy congregation of rooks. When I got my breath back, I peered out to see what was afoot below, and saw Mr. Rosenkreutz's bullies, now dressed as gamekeepers, beating the undergrowth for me. So I stayed put until night came on again. Then I went from covert to covert, always concealing myself, until I came to the railway line and borrowed a ride off a load of freight, climbed in amongst a truck of taters and pulled a tarpaulin over my head, because at that time I was not able to fly so high the clouds might hide me, and I can think of few things more conspicuous, even by night, than a naked woman dodging telegraph wires and hopping over signal boxes, for I needed the railway to guide me back to London. To my delight, the train soon steamed through Clapham Junction, and I nipped out just by Battersea Park, to make my way with all speed through the empty dark up the Queenstown Road, ducking behind the privet hedges as I went, until I got at last happily home. Where who do I find in my own bed beside Lizzie, but them Sleeping Beauty? I was so weary, so bedraggled, so hungry, and my nerves so much on edge from my dreadful experience, that I broke down and cried that there was no room for me at the inn. So Lizzie woke up.
Wasn't I pleased to see her, I can tell you, for Toussaint had told all, and we feared the worst. Our house was packed to the roof with the refugees from Madame Shrek's, and if Feathers had a tale to tell, oh, we had a tale for her.
I fixed her up a nice cup of coffee with milk, and she had a couple of boiled eggs and some toast, and soon all was smiles again. As for Toussaint's part in this scarcely credible narrative, sir, he wrote it down on a piece of paper, which, happily, I have with me in my handbag. Lizzie thereupon excavated three impeccable sheets of manuscript, written on invoices for an ice cream parlour as follows.
After the man came and kidnapped Sophia, I was much distressed, and would have followed them, but the carriage vanished too quickly from my sight. I returned to the house and went to Madame Shrek's room, but though the widow's weeds still hung from the curtain rod, now they were quite still. She did not move. It came to me that there was nothing left inside the clothes, and perhaps there never had been anything inside her clothes but a set of dry bones, agitated only by the power of an infernal will, and a voice that had been no more than the artificial exhalation of air from a bladder or a sack, that she was or had become a sort of scarecrow of desire. I climbed on a chair and lifted her down. She was weightless as an empty basket, and her mittens fell to the floor with a soft plop. A little dust trickled out of the truncated fingers. I laid her weeds on the bed. They were stiff and dry as the shed carapace of an insect. On her desk was a bill of sale. She had sold Feathers to this Mr. Rosenkreutz for not 2 but 5,000 pounds, have to be paid direct in cash to Madame Shrek when the bargain was struck, the rest to go to her afterwards. All Feathers had been told was lies. I did not like the sound of that afterwards in the least, but I was at my wit's end what to do next. I knew I had been the dumb witness to infamy, but would the police believe that I, the last to have seen Madame Shrek living, had been the first to find her, not dead, for who can say now when she had died, or if she had ever lived, but passed away? And who better than I to know what powerful friends the old procuress had in the force, since every Friday since I entered her service, to me had fallen the task of taking by hand a heavy envelope to Kensington Police Station with orders to wait for no receipt. Fanny was a pillar of strength. From Madame Shrek's open safe, she took the money that was owed on Feather's account, and then, after some computations, a sufficient sum to recompense all the remaining 5, including the beauty, for the labor they had expended in that miserable place, not a penny more, not a penny less. Having dealt honestly with Madame Shrek's estate. Now, she said, let's be off sharpish, or else we'll be accessories to the fact. What fact? I asked myself, gripped with fear. But we could do nothing except pray that Feather's wit and ingenuity would keep her from harm. As to a place of refuge for we friendless ones, all I could think of was the address Feathers herself once gave me, where I took the first and only cash Madame Shrek ever gave her. We must be gone, and quickly, before the first clients of the night arrived. I carried the beauty out to Madame Shrek's carriage and the mews myself. I would take that carriage and the pony as a portion due to me. Did not the slave deserve to inherit the means of escape? We arrived at Battersea just after midnight, and those kind folk rose from their beds to give us a hospitable welcome, in spite of their distress at hearing of our beloved girl's disappearance, and disorder found couches, mattresses, and blankets for us all. The next day seemed interminable, as in a state of agitation that increased hourly, we waited for news of our lovely friend. Only, after a long night's watch, had the house settled down for a few hours' uneasy slumber, when she, miraculously, returned. Walser read this document, noted the scholarly handwriting, the firm signature, the all-too-checkable address. He handed it back to Lizzie humbly. She stowed it away again, with a pleased nod. "That Toussaint," she said, "he's a lovely way with words." "What has become of them all, sir?" demanded Feathers, and immediately answering herself, "Why, gone their ways. Isotta and Gianni, most loving parents themselves, persuaded the wonder that no child can fall so far, a mother nor father will not stoop to lift it up again. So she presented herself again to her adopteds, who wept with joy to have her restored to the bosom of the family after so many years, when all their other fledglings had long left the nest. Albert Albertina got a post as a lady's maid with our Jenny. And though Shahi says Shahi is much confined by female garments all the time, Jenny would not be without her treasure. Fanny returned to her native Yorkshire, where, with the aid of her savings at Madame Shrek's, she established an orphanage in a mill town for the children of operatives killed in accidents on the loons. So now she has 20 lovely babies to call her mama. Happily, since I came into my good fortune, I've been able to interest a good friend, the academician Sir R. F., in cobwebs. He perceived her unique quality of vision and trained her hand to match her sight. Now, she had a fine reputation as a painter in chiaroscuro, so you could say that though she had not come out of the shadows, all the same, she had made the shadows work for her. As for the beauty, she is with us still.
Pause of 3 heartbeats. She sleeps, and now she wakes each day a little less, and each day takes less and less nourishment, as if grudging the least moment of wakefulness, for from the movements under her eyelids and the somnolent gestures of her hands and feet, it seems as if her dreams grow more urgent and intense, as if the life she leads in the closed world of dreams is now about to possess her utterly, as if her small, increasingly reluctant wakenings were an interruption of some more vital existence. So she is loath to spend even those few necessary moments of wakefulness with us. Wakings, strange as her sleepings. A marvellous fate. A sleep more lifelike than the living. A dream which consumes the world. And so, concluded Feathers, in a voice that now took on the sombre, majestic tones of a great organ, we do believe her dream will be the coming century, and, oh God, how frequently she weeps. Followed a profound silence, as the women clutched hands, as if for comfort, and Walser shivered, for the dressing room had grown cold as death. Then, on the soundless air of night, now drifted to them the sound of Big Ben once again. But the wind must have changed direction a little, for the first chimes were faint with distance, as if they came from very far away. And when she heard them, Feathers froze, and pointed, just like a huge golden retriever. She thrust up her muzzle as if sniffing the air, and the muscles in her neck bunched and clenched. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. During the less than a blink of time it took the last chime to die, there came a vertiginous sensation, as if Walser and his companions and the very dressing room itself were all at once precipitated down a vast chute. It took his breath away, as if the room that had, in some way without his knowledge, been plucked out of its everyday temporal continuum had been held for a while above the spinning world and was now dropped back into place.
6 o'clock? As light as that?
Cried Lizzie, springing to her feet with refreshed energy. But Feathers seemed as if utterly overcome, exhausted to the point of collapse quite suddenly, as if by the relaxation of tremendous amounts of energy. Her breast fluttered, as if her heart wanted to fly out. Her heavy head hung down, like a bell that had ceased tolling. She even seemed to have diminished in size, to have shrunk to proportions only a little more colossal than human. She closed her eyes and let out a long exhalation of breath. The colour left her cheeks, and she looked haggard and very much aged in the colourless light of morning that gave the mauve glow of the gas mantles a lifeless and unnatural look. It was left to Lizzie to conclude the story, which she did with dispatch.
"After our joyful reunion," stated Lizzie briskly, as we all sat lingering over breakfast, "who should call in on us but Esmeralda and the human eel pushing an elver in a perambulator?"
"Tell you what, Feathers," she says, "you ever thought of the eye trapeze?"
Then Lizzie bounded up and began to fold and tidy the lingerie on the sofa, tacitly dismissing Walser. But Feathers, stirred a little, eyed Walser in the glass, wearily added a coda.
"The rest is history. Esmeralda secured me the first engagement at the Cirque d'Hiver. No sooner did I venture on the high trapeze than I triumphed. Paris, Berlin, Rome, Vienna, and now my own beloved London. The first night here, at the Alhambra, after I'd climbed off stage over a snowden of bouquets, when Lizzie was taking off my makeup, just as we were when you found us, comes a knocking on the door. And there's a man in a billycock hat, with a big paunch covered with a waistcoat, made of stars and stripes, the jolly old glory itself, sir, and right over his belly button, a bloody great dollar sign. 'Hi there, my feathered friend,' he says. 'I've come to make your fortune.'"
She yawned, not like a whale, not like a lioness, but like a girl who has stayed up too long.
"So I don't doubt I'll soon triumph in St. Petersburg, in Tokyo, in Seattle, in San Francisco, Chicago, New York, wherever there's a roof beam high enough for my trapeze, sir. Now, if you've quite finished..."
Walser snapped his notebook shut. There was no room in it for one more word.
"Yes, indeed. That's fine, Miss Sophie, just fine."
"Feathers," she corrected sharply. "Call me Feathers. Now me and Liz must get home to bed."
"Can I call you a cab?"
"Gracious, no. Waste good money on a cab. We always walk home after the show."
But she tottered a little as she got up. The night had taken a heavy toll. She exchanged a last inscrutable grimace with her warped reflection in the mirror. "Excuse me, sir, will I get some clothes on?"
"I'll wait at the stage door, ma'am," said Walser, stowing away his book. "Perhaps you ladies will allow me to escort you?"
They looked at each other.
"Oh, he can come as far as the bridge, can't he?"
The stage doorkeeper, in his creaking leather coat, was brewing tea on his oil stove, stewing up tea leaves, milk and sugar, all together, Indian style. Walser accepted a boiling jam jar full of the stuff. The October morning grew lighter every moment, but no brighter. It was a grey day of low cloud. The discarded aughts of pleasure littered the pavement outside.
"Been all night with Feathers, have you?"
said the stage doorkeeper with a wink and a nudge.
"Go on, don't take offence, Governor. That Lizzie guards her like a watchdog. Besides, she's a perfect lady, is our Feathers.
Yet, rolled up in a rusty black shawl, the big bones sticking through her face, dark stains under those blue eyes, her long hair roughly pinned up again, she looked like any street girl making her way home after an unsuccessful night, or even some girl rag-and-bone merchant taking home a night's dollar of scavenging in a sack on her back. The enormous burden, jutting out between her shoulders, that seemed to weigh her down. She sparked into a semblance of theatrical vivacity for the sake of the stage doorkeeper. "I'll see you later, me old cock," but refused Walter's offered arm, and they walked through Piccadilly in silence, among early risers on their way to work. They skirted Nelson's Column, went down Whitehall. The cold air was not freshened by morning. There was an oppressive odour of soot and horse shit. At the end of Whitehall, along the wide road, past the Mother of Parliaments, there came at a brisk trot a coal cart pulled by clattering, jingling drays, and behind an impromptu procession of women of the poorest class, without coats or wraps, in cotton pinafores, in draggled underskirts, worn carpet slippers on their bare feet, and there were shoeless little children, too, running, scrambling after the carts, the girls and the women with their pinafores outstretched, to catch every little fragment of coal that might bounce out. "Oh, my lovely London," said Feathers. "The shining city, the new Jerusalem." She spoke so flatly, he could not tell whether she spoke ironically. She said nothing else. Walser was intrigued by such silence, after such loquacity. It was as though she had taken him as far as she could go on the brazen trajectory of her voice, yarned him in knots, and then stopped short, dropped him. Atop the sparkling tracery of the house, the gilt hands of Big Ben pointed to 7:05. Both women looked up at the clock face and smiled a single small smile of complicity, of which Walser received the faded aftermath as she turned to shake his hand. A strong, firm, masculine grip. No gloves. "It's been a pleasure, Mr. Walser," she said. "I hope you've got enough to do your piece. If you have any further questions, you know where to find me. We can easily make our way home by ourselves from here."
"It's been a pleasure,"
agreed Lizzie, with an odd little ducking bow, proffering a glacé kid glove.
"My pleasure entirely," said Walser.
The minute hand of the great clock above them inched over the face. The women set out for the smoky south over Westminster Bridge, against the clattering traffic that now streamed into town. Because of the difference in their heights, they could not walk arm in arm, so they held hands, and from a distance looked like a blonde heroic mother taking her little daughter home from some ill-fated expedition up west, their ages obscured, their relationship inverted. Their feet dragged slow as poverty, yet that too was an illusion. Pelted with diamonds, assaulted by pearls, she was too mean to take a cab. The clock coughed up the prolegomena to its chime, and then rang out the prelude to the hour. When the wind suddenly seized hold of Feather's hair, tugged it from its pin, and sent it flying over the sullen river in a wide flaxen arc, he half expected her to unfurl too, all scarlet crimson plumage, and clasping her tiny charge, her daughter, her mother, to her bosom, to whirl away up through the low ceiling of cloud, up and off. He shook his head to clear away idle fancies. 7 struck. Now the size of one big doll, one small doll, they reached the end of the bridge and looked back. He saw the pale wedges of their faces. Then traffic obscured them.
"Cab, sir."
The waiting horse blew a plume of oats over the top of the nosebag. At his lodgings in Clerkenwell, Walser washed, shaved, changed his shirt, and found this morning he preferred his landlady's ingratiating, if inept, attempt at American coffee to the tea he usually drank. Lizzie had marinated his insides in strong tea that night until his esophagus must be the colour of mahogany. He flicked through his notes.
What a performance! Such style! Such vigour! And just how had the two women pulled off that piece of sleight of hand, or ear rather, with the clocks? When he took out his own pocket watch, he found, to his unsurprise, it had stopped short, precisely at midnight. But how had she done, or known that? Curiouser and curiouser. A war correspondent between wars, and a passionate amateur of the tall tale, he dropped in at his London office later that morning to find his chief brooding behind a green eyeshadow over the latest from South Africa.
"How did you find the Cockney Venus?"
"It's the ambition," said Walser, "of every red-blooded American kid to run away with a circus."
"So?"
said his London chief. "I don't think you realize just how much I'd like a break from hard news, chief. That last touch of yellow fever in Panama took more out of me than I thought. Keep me away from the battlefield for a while. I need to be refreshed. I need to have my sense of wonder polished up again. What would you say to a series of inside stories of the exotic, of the marvelous, of laughter and tears and thrills and all? What if, incognito, your correspondent follows the great confidence artiste in the history of the world to the world's most fabulous cities, through the trackless wastes of Siberia, and then even unto the land of the rising sun? Better still, why doesn't your correspondent, incognito, sign up with Fevers on Captain Kearney's Great Imperial Tour itself? The story straight from the ringbark, chief. Let me invite you to spend a few nights at the circus."
Part 2. Petersburg. Chapter 1.
"There was a pig," said the babushka to little Ivan, who perched round-eyed on a three-legged stool beside her in the kitchen, as she blew on the charcoal underneath the samovar with a big pair of wooden bellows brightly painted with folk art motifs of scrolls and flowers. The toil-misshapen back of the babushka humbly bowed before the bubbling urn in the impotently submissive obeyance of one who pleads for a respite or a mercy she knows in advance will not be forthcoming, and her hands, those worn, veiny hands that had involuntarily burnished the handles of the bellows over decades of use, those immemorial hands of hers, slowly parted and came together again, just as slowly, in a hypnotically reiterated gesture that was as if she were about to join her hands in prayer. About to join her hands in prayer, but always, at the very last moment, as if it came to her there was something about the house that must be done first, she would start to part her hands again. Then Martha would turn back into Mary and protest to the Martha within her, "What can be more important than praying?" Nevertheless, when her hands were once more almost joined, that inner Martha recalled the Mary to the indeed perhaps more important thing, whatever it was, and so on. Had the bellows been invisible, such would have been the drama of the constantly repeated interruption of the sequence, so that, when the old woman blew on the charcoal with the bellows, it could have been, if a wind had come and whipped away the bellows, a little paradigm of the tension between the flesh and the spirit, although tension would have been an altogether too energetic word for it, since her weariness modified the pace of this imaginary indecision to such an extent that if you did not know her, you would think that she was lazy. And more than this, her work suggested a kind of infinite incompletion. That a woman's work is never done? How the work of all the Marthas, and all the Marys too, all the work, both temporal and spiritual in this world, and in preparation for the next, will never be over. Always some conflicting demand will occur to postpone indefinitely any and every task. So, there was no need to hurry. Which was just as well, because she was almost worn out. All Russia was contained within the thwarted circumscription of her movements, and much of the essence of her abused and withered femaleness. Symbol and woman, or symbolic woman, she crouched before the samovar.
The charcoal grew red, grew black, blackened and reddened to the rhythm of wheezing sighs that might just as well have come from the worn-out lungs of the babushka as from her bellows. Her slow, somber movements, her somber, slow speech, were filled with the dignity of the hopeless. There was. A pig, went to Petersburg. Petersburg. At that, the charcoal glowed and sizzled. Petersburg, the very name, enough to perk you up, even when you lived there. Even the exhausted soul of Mother Russia stirred, a little. St. Petersburg, a beautiful city that does not exist anymore. Today another beautiful city of a different name bestrides the mighty Neva. On its site, St. Petersburg once stood. Russia is a sphinx. You grand immobility, antique, hieratic, one haunch squatting on Asia, the other on Europe. What exemplary destiny are you knitting out of the blood and sinew of history in your sleeping womb? She does not answer. Riddles bounce off her sides, as gaily painted as those of a peasant troika. Russia is a sphinx. St. Petersburg, the beautiful smile of her face. Petersburg, loveliest of all hallucinations, the shimmering mirage in the northern wilderness, glimpsed for a breathless second between black forest and the frozen sea. Within the city, the sweet geometry of every prospect. Outside, limitless Russia and the approaching storm. Walser paused to flex his chilly fingers and insert a fresh sheet of paper into his typewriter. At the command of the prince, the rocks of the wilderness transformed, turned into palaces. The prince stretched out his lordly hand, pulled down the northern lights, used them for chandeliers. Yes! Built as St. Petersburg was at the whim of a tyrant who wanted his memory of Venice to take form again in stone on a marshy shore at the end of the world under the most inhospitable of skies, this city, put together brick by brick by poets, charlatans, adventurers, and crazed priests, by slaves, by exiles, this city bears that prince's name, which is the same name as the saint who holds the keys of heaven, St. Petersburg, a city built of hubris, imagination, and desire. As we are, ourselves, or as we ought to be. The old woman and the child ignored the rattling of the typewriter behind them. They do not know what we know about their city. They lived on without knowledge or surmise in this city that is on the point of becoming legend, but not yet, not quite yet. The city, this sleeping beauty of a city, stirs and murmurs, longing yet fearing the rough and bloody kiss that will awaken her, tugging at her moorings in the past, striving, yearning to burst through the present into the violence of that authentic history to which this narrative, as must by now be obvious, does not belong. Its boulevards of peach and vanilla stucco dissolves in mists of autumn, in the sugar syrup of nostalgia, acquiring the elaboration of artifice. I am inventing an imaginary city as I go along. Toward such a city, the babushka's pig now trots. There was a pig, went to Petersburg to pray, said the weary babushka, laying aside the bellows on which blossomed the only flowers in the barren garden of her life. She turned the spigot of the samovar onto a glass. How her old bones did ache! How bitterly she regretted having promised the child a story.
What happened to the pig?
Prompted little Ivan, all eyes and spindle shanks, sucking a hot jam pie. But it turns out the babushka can't be bothered with the pig and its story. No Scheherazade, she. Wolf eat him.
Take this tea to the gentleman and get out from under my feet. Get along out of doors with you. Go play, boy.
She fell to genuflecting in front of the icon. She might have prayed for the soul of her daughter, the murderess, had she not been so weary she could do no more than perform the physical rituals of faith. In the shadowy recesses of the dour, soot-stained room, Walser, an indistinct yet vivid figure, sat at a crude wooden table, banging out those first impressions of the city on a battered old Underwood portable, his faithful companion in war and insurrection. The child in felt boots inched reluctantly up and set down the glass of tea as far away from the typist as he was able. "Spare Sibo." Walser's flying fingers